Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this year, the state of Delaware offered an updated plan to address so-called forever chemicals in drinking water, soil, and air. But mitigating the presence of PFAS chemicals is a complicated and costly effort. And under the Trump administration, the federal government's support for that effort is something of a mixed bag. While the EPA recently announced it will spend $1 billion nationwide and $10 million in Delaware to help, the agency is at the same time rolling back Biden-era regulations to manage PFAS. This week, contributor John Hurl takes a closer look at how the EPA's actions affect the first state in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to discuss what he learned. So, John, let's set the table here a little bit. As your story notes, the Trump administration's EPA has rolled back Biden-era PFAS regulations. Remind our listeners what those rollbacks do.
Well, by way of background here, Tom, PFAS was first regulated at a national level by the Biden administration back in April of 24. And that regulated, that set health limits for six kinds of PFAS. That action was actually long awaited by activists. It followed regulation by some states, including Delaware, which proposed its own limits. But those were overtaken by strict federal limits that were set by the Biden administration. Now, what's happened under the Trump administration is that rolled back some of these limits that were set by its predecessor. Specifically, what the Trump EPA has done is to delay the compliance deadlines for utilities to meet the limits on two PFAS chemicals, that is PFOA and PFOS. Those are commonly found. And then it also rescinded the regulations on four other kinds of PFAS.
And this comes as we learn a little bit more about the current scope of PFAS issues in the region from a Delaware River Basin Commission report. What did we learn from that DRBC report?
Essentially that PFAS remain widespread in the Delaware River Basin, especially in the southern reaches of it around the state of Delaware. That report by the interstate regulator, the DRBC, was based on 3 years work in 21 sites, including Wilmington and the Christina River, and it also singled out Peapatch Island for particularly high levels of PFAS concentration. So essentially what this report was saying, it came out at the end of May, was that the authorities have a long way to go in controlling PFAS in the region.
A lot of ways just kind of confirming what we already know from testing that's been done here in the state otherwise.
That's correct.
So, John, recently the EPA did announce it will send out $1 billion nationwide to help address PFAS issues, including $10 million here in Delaware. What is this money targeted to do? What is it essentially trying to accomplish?
Yeah, well, it's intended to help local communities to treat and install filters to remove PFAS from their water systems. The idea is this money is targeted not only at communities but also to the operators of water systems and private well owners.
So, with that in mind, who's going to be handling the Delaware portion of the funding, and how much can $10 million do realistically here in the first state?
Well, the money is going first of all to the Division of Public Health, and they're going to be making what they call sub awards to local communities that do have a PFAS problem. And what DPH has said is that they call this $10 million, quote, an important investment, but they also point out that the scale of the problem significantly exceeds the resources available. So the state of Delaware is saying, well, this is all very nice, but it's not really going to fix this problem.
And is it fair to say that some of the advocates and activists you've talked to are worried about this relatively low amount of funding combined with the regulatory rollbacks?
Well, indeed. I spoke with Dr. Jerry Kaufman, who he's the director of the University of Delaware's Water Resources Center. And he essentially made the same point that DPH was saying, was making, is that, you know, $10 million is a decent amount of money, but it is nowhere near enough to fix the problem. And he illustrates his argument there by talking about, you know, by his estimate for the amount of money that it costs to install PFAS filters. So, for example, Kaufman has said that it costs between $2 and $5 million to install PFAS filters on a water system serving around about 10,000 people. Now, I mean, although major water utilities like Veolia have fitted PFAS filters, the latest federal grant really isn't anywhere near enough to protect approximately 1 million residents statewide.
How does the EPA respond to those arguments and those concerns that are brought up by DPH and advocates like Dr. Kaufman?
Well, that you can sum that up in one word is pushback. They're saying that the monitoring and reporting deadlines that are now required by the Trump EPA are the same as those that were required by the Biden EPA. They do say that some compliance deadlines have been extended, and so the reason that they've been extended, the Trump EPA says, is to give water utilities time to comply without risking the violations that would result in fines, and of course those would be passed on to the communities that those water systems serve.
You did, though, talk to some advocates who suggest the current EPA actions suggest kind of a change in approach from the federal government. What do they feel that the EPA is signaling with the way it's handling things now under the Trump administration?
Well, the suggestion is that the EPA is beginning to emphasize prevention rather than cure. And Dr. Kaufman, for one, was actually pretty positive about that. I mean, on the simple basis that, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I mean, it's a lot more expensive to remove PFAS. Contamination once it's entered a water system than to prevent it entering the system in the first place. And Kaufman, who has been a pretty stern critic of EPA's environmental rollbacks, he mentioned as an illustration here, he's identified PFAS pollution in Red Clay Creek in Newcastle County as originating in two factories there, and he said that, you know, if that source was stopped, then of course, you know, the pollution levels in that creek would go down.
So, John, ultimately, is addressing PFAS, at least for now, largely going to wind up in the hands of states and local governments, as we saw with the PFAS implementation plan Delaware released earlier this year that you had reported on?
Well, I think it's fair to say that we're looking at a two-track approach here. In Delaware, the state is not only DPH but also DENREC is continuing to work on the PFAS problem. They issued a report earlier this year, which gave the public an update on, you know, 10 years of work on EPA on PFAS. And of course, I mean, the EPA, no doubt, would soundly reject the idea that the federal government is somehow washing its hands of this. So I think it's probably fair to say that we're looking at a continuation of state action on the problem, coupled with a possible move towards at the federal level, a move towards prevention rather than cure.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. John's piece looking at how federal PFAS policy affects Delaware is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us, we dig into a new effort to get more out of the 2.5-year-old Claymont Transportation Center. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm Tom Byrne. When the new Claymont Transportation Center opened in December 2024, it completed some 2 decades of work to bring a new train station to Claymont. And it was hailed as a foundational piece in the effort to redevelop the former Claymont Steel site and the surrounding community. But 2.5 years later, the facility is largely underutilized, sparking a new effort to make the Claymont Transportation Center the kind of hub it was intended to be. The Claymont PHL Connector Initiative seeks to bring a regional shuttle service connecting the Claymont Transportation Center to Philadelphia International Airport and more in the Philadelphia area. The driving force behind the initiative is Tony Benson, CEO of EpiMind Consulting, who joined me earlier this week to discuss this new effort. So, Tony, this is a project that centers around the Claymont Transportation Center, the new Claymont train station, as some people kind of refer to it. And I wanted to start with the current status of that transportation center. It took decades to get it built, opened with great fanfare about its potential for Claymont and the surrounding area. But right now it seems underutilized. Do we have a sense of what kind of usage that the transportation center is actually getting at this point?
Yes, well, absolutely. You know, Delaware residents need more convenient transportation and options between Philadelphia, you know, like Philadelphia International Airport. And, you know, before the pandemic, there's about 200,000 people traveling before this was built, you know, annually. And then after the pandemic, of course, people started working more remotely, which really, really hit the transportation center. So by the time everything rolled out, there wasn't many people there. So right now, not much, and a lot of stops are being, you know, it's being skipped, Claymont, for the most part right now. But it's really, really inspired me to do something about it, for sure. Yes.
So you and some others are testing the waters on what you're calling the Claymont PHL Connector, which essentially, I guess, is a shuttle service using the Claymont Transportation Center as a base. Can you just give us a little bit of a detail of what you're envisioning with this project? What are you hoping you can create here?
Well, right now, you know, I met with the transportation officials, you know, community leaders, elected officials and stakeholders, you know, now the designated location at Claymont Transportation Center. So I've been like really, really working on it to actually scale from there. Start with Philly International Airport, but then hotels, you know, actually getting a chance to go over to some of the actual, you know, concerts and things that are happening over in Philadelphia, but build a bridge and also give opportunities for people in Claymont, Newcastle County, and the state of Delaware.
You're currently conducting an online survey to get some feedback on this concept. Have you gotten an early sense of what people think of this concept and the idea of using the Claymont Transportation Center as a base to get to the airport or other things in Philadelphia that they would normally at this point drive to?
Absolutely. Nearly 500 residents now have already expressed support through the survey. And I asked a wide range of questions. You know, how often would you use the transportation shuttle? Where would you like to go? Over 95% said Philly International Airport. Then you had some people that wanted to go to events and concerts. And, you know, some people will be traveling from out of town, college students, so on and so forth. But the biggest, you know, response was Philly International Airport. And they're already ready. They're looking, you know, they're all local. The demographic is basically local between Claymont, you know, Bear, Newark, you know, a few other places. And it's been great, the response. They're actually thanking me. They said, thank you. We really wanted to be able to get directly there instead of going everywhere else to get to where we want to go.
I mean, the airport seems like a no-brainer piece of this thing, but the one I guess that jumped out at me was things like sporting events in South Philadelphia, Eagles, Sixers, Phillies. And it would be a natural, I guess, in part because if the price is right in the neighborhood of what they would pay for parking, this would make sense. Is that the sense you're kind of getting, that people feel like, well, if I could take my parking money and put it toward this, my life might be a little bit easier.
A whole lot easier because the parking is free. You know, at the McDowell Transit Center, it's free. So all they would have to pay for is 24-hour security there, cameras there. So they'll be able to go ahead, park their car, travel, whether they're going to an event, going to see a game, or just leaving for a few days to be able to come back to just coming back and getting their car and going home. So that right there has been big. And then also not having to deal with the traffic, driving and having to sit in the, you know, the traffic, being late for flights, those kind of things. That was a really, really strong response as well.
I was going to say two things. One, I was at a Phillies game this week myself. Getting there was not bad, but getting out was mind-numbing at times, trying to get out so I could see where people would feel that. And I guess also just hearing that, for instance, the World Cup is in Philadelphia. They're charging $150 for parking. So the idea of having free, secure parking that you could get in Delaware and then shuttle up to that, it seems like there is a natural selling point right there.
Absolutely. And of course, FIFA being here, some FIFA athletes are literally staying in Delaware. And again, just building awareness of what Claymont has to offer. It's not just a place you pass through. You know, you can actually stop, you know, be able to park your car, drive somewhere, meet some people. You know, there's a lot of changes that are coming, but I feel like this will be a big part of that. And again, giving opportunities to people in Claymont.
So you do see it as an opportunity to kind of fulfill the promise of this transportation center that was going to be part of this greater redevelopment of Claymont, that it would connect to businesses, residential, and things like that. So you do feel like there's still that possibility of a connection with the greater Claymont redevelopment.
Absolutely, without question. I mean, if you go up to just anyone and ask them about the Claymont Transportation Center, they'd have no clue that it exists. It's a unicorn. Where it is, where it's located, a lot of people don't know, but to know about it, when I say free parking, location, they're like, what? I had no idea. So yeah, I mean, I really feel like this would be a great way to get people to come out, to be able to utilize this transportation center, and then also have some events there. You know, have some things that'll bring people together in the community. You know, I'm thinking carnival and a few other things, but just something that will bring people together.
I'm curious, you're looking at interest right now in doing this survey. If the interest is strong enough, do you have a sense of how this would work? Would you be looking for a private company to run this? Is there an existing model elsewhere that you could duplicate?
Well, a bit of both.
Okay.
There's nothing new under the sun. So, but not only that, I'm already talking to an operating company, a generational company. I'm not going to say their name yet, but basically they'll do what they do best when it comes to the day-to-day, you know, having the actual shuttles there, operating. And for me, I am bridging the gap and just making sure that things run smoothly and able to, you know, make sure we're getting, that's another reason why we're in pilot mode right now. And I have the survey going out to see what people want and then connect the two. So yes, absolutely. I'll be partnering with the company.
Everything, of course, costs money. Do you envision the need to seek state or county funding to help get this off the ground or maintain kind of the security piece and kind of the infrastructure of the station to make this work the way that people will feel very comfortable with it?
Yeah, well, I'll say, you know, it has nothing to do with the government at all. I mean, I was able to work and get an MOA with, you know, with DART. And they were more than willing and happy. You know, of course, John Sisson, you know, this is a vision of his and a few others. And it's amazing. So I just came up with an opportunity. And, you know, so just said, hey, there's your spot. You know, I have a banner that'll be going up pretty soon. And they've been very supportive of it. But basically, ticket prices, the same model you would use for getting on the actual bus or catching a Lyft, but not as expensive. Catching Uber, but not as expensive, but gets you to where you need to go without having to pay any government fees. A lot of people ask, you know, so how much do I have to pay the government? It has nothing to do with that.
So you see it's definitely kind of a self-sustaining operation is what you envision.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
So what's next after the survey? You know, I guess how long do you intend to keep doing this survey? And then kind of, you know, what would the next steps be once you kind of gather all that data?
Well, the key is to build demand, which we're doing right now. And of course, with the company that I'm partnering with, I'm able to bring that and understand that we have people that really would like to travel And once we solidify that, I have a waiting list already. We just get it going. Of course, I'm building more private and public partnerships, Salina National Airport, local hotels, those kind of things there. But I'm doing that now in the interim. But we get it going, actually, and
Is the feeling you would probably kind of roll it out in phases? Like it seems like the airport thing might be the natural starting point, and then
yes.
kind of phase things in depending on the demand and as maybe awareness builds. Is that kind of the template you're looking
Absolutely.
for?
Absolutely. The scale from there, we start with Philly International Airport. We start with a small shuttle, not a, bunch of things, good 15 to 20 something seats, and then we build from there. And as we start to build more and go from there, then hotels, then arenas, those kind of things there. So just one step at a time.
So where can people find the survey if they want to give you their input and what they would like to see at an operation like this?
Absolutely. So basically, you can definitely email me. It's online as well. I'm not sure if you saw the support from Councilman Cartier, from Brett Sadler, from Senator Ray Siegfried, and a few others. It's all on their page. It has a QR code there. It'll be on my page with the actual banner. And then I'll have a website that'll be rolling out as well pretty soon. If anyone needs to get in contact with me, please feel free to email Claymont, PHL Connector, at gmail.com. You can reach out to me directly, 267-738-7300. And I'll be more than willing to not only ask any questions, but also be able to send, resources.
Do you have any kind of timetable to roll it out, or is that still kind of a work in progress?
It's still a work in progress, but right now I'm looking at before the summer's over. If we can get between mid-July, honestly, if it was up to me and things went the way I originally planned, it would have rolled out around FIFA. It would have been happening already. But again, the key is just to see what people want. Give them the opportunity to say what they want, So that's where we are. So I'm giving it end of July, sometime in August.
Anything else you think we need to know about the project or people need to know about the project?
It's happening. It went from, just a vision. I was out of brain surgery in 2024. And, I just really, really thought about it. And in fact, the minute I walked to Claymont Transportation Center, McDowell Transit Station, I fell in love with it. And I really, really see, opportunity for people and to be able to move. And I remember after having brain surgery, I couldn't move, couldn't go anywhere. I had to get, a ride here and a ride there. And I'm like, what if I can just go somewhere and I could just get. And that's what basically gave birth to it. And that was a reality. So I will keep everyone posted. And I'm looking forward to, serving.
Thanks to EpiMind Consulting CEO Tony Benson for joining us on The Green this week to talk about the Claymont PHL Connector. You can get more information on the Claymont PHL Connector project and how to take the survey about it by emailing claymontphlconnector@gmail.com. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we preview a discussion of art crime being presented by the Biggs Museum. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Thomas Crown Affair, How to Steal a Million, Ocean's 12. Art heists are a popular subject for films, television, and books. A talk this Thursday presented by the Biggs Museum of American Art brings two experts to Dover's Schwartz Center for the Arts to talk about real-life art crimes. Robert Whitman is a former FBI special agent who founded the Bureau's Art Crimes Team. During his career, he helped recover hundreds of millions of dollars worth of stolen art. He'll be joined at the talk by Laura Evans, distinguished teaching professor at the University of North Texas and an art crime historian. On this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny speaks with Whitman about the real world of art crime and his career.
Well, first, tell me about this event in Dover and what you and your co-presenter, Laura Evans, will be talking about.
So Thursday, June 25th, we're going to be doing a presentation, Laura Evans and myself, about art crime. And it's going to be two different aspects. Laura is a professor out of a university in Texas, has written a book about art crime. And she'll be speaking about the history some of the stories of art theft investigations, some of the stories from the past that are interesting and insightful about art crime and art criminals, for that matter. On the other hand, I was an FBI agent for 20 years. My primary job at the FBI was art crime investigations. So I'm going to be talking about certain stories involving thefts, frauds, forgeries, fakes, those types of things that we investigated at the FBI. Most of my work throughout that time was as an undercover agent. So generally speaking, it's not hard to prove that material is stolen. It's hard to prove the knowledge. In other words, that someone knows that that material is stolen, or to bring it out of the woodwork, so to speak, to get it back. So I did a lot of undercover work, worked in maybe 20 countries around the world. And we'll be talking about some of those stories. So the listeners who come will be hearing it from the man who was in the room, so to speak. That was my job.
And when you were working undercover, was that posing as generally like a buyer or an appraiser?
Yeah, my undercover operations included all different aspects of art, of the art business. You know, a lot of people know about art history. They'd understand that, you know, Renoir had arthritis at the end of his life and had a hard time holding his brushes, and that Monet went blind and Van Gogh cut off his ear. These are all famous stories of artists. When it comes to art crime, it's about the art business world, how to do a deal in the art business world. So I would pose as a shady dealer. I would be a unintelligent or uneducated buyer to be defrauded, an easy mark, so to speak. I'd be an art professor, depending on authentication and what they wanted me to do. I posed as a buyer for the Russian mob. So it all depended on what the specific case entailed, and I would do that.
And you started the art crime unit within the FBI. Was there institutional resistance to that at first?
Well, it didn't start till 2005. So I was probably, I'd say, almost 17 years into my career at the FBI. And from 1993 to 2005, I had been working art almost exclusively. And I think the FBI realized that there's some great publicity aspects to recovering stolen art. So in the end, I think they saw the benefit of setting up an art crime team. And quite honestly, I had wanted one for quite a while, working with the Carabinieri in Italy and the OCBC in Paris, and having worked with the Art and Antique Squad, Scotland Yard. I identified that we needed an FBI art squad, something that would be comparable to all these Western European nations around the world. So I went to headquarters after doing a specifically interesting case in Copenhagen, Denmark, working with the Swedish National Police and the Danish police, where we recovered a $35 million stolen Rembrandt. After recovering that, we went to headquarters and we convinced them that it would be a good idea to start this art crime team.
I don't want to ask you to give away all the good stuff before your talk, but is there one particular investigation that you're especially proud to have been a part of?
Well, there were many, many investigations involving everything from the Antiques Roadshow to undercover operations, from gunpoint thefts to recoveries of paintings from the Louvre in Paris, and also the Musée d'Orsay. So there were many different operations. One that I usually don't talk about, but I'm kind of proud of it, was there was a theft, a heist from the National Museum in Zimbabwe. And an individual went in, stole two Makonde masks, which are the cultural heritage of the country, and a number of other pieces out of the main museum. He made his way to the airport and then bribed guards to let him go back to Poland. So we had, he then offered these things for sale to a collector in Denver, Colorado. And as a result, I posed as a buyer, an undercover operation in Poland, in Warsaw. We were able to recover these pieces for the National Museum in Zimbabwe. And I thought that was really a great recovery. It wasn't the largest dollar recovery. There was one piece we recovered worth $100 million. It was one of the original 13 copies of the Bill of Rights, but it represented the cultural heritage of the country. And as a result, I thought that was a particularly, important investigation.
And you bring up what I think is a really important point here, because you're talking about the Bill of Rights, you're talking about documents, flags, masks. You mentioned baseball cards. This is about so much more than just expensive paintings from museums.
Right. You know, when we talk about this, I'll bring this up at the talk. The fact is that it's a $200 billion industry every year, bought and sold, all of the cultural heritage, all the cultural property in the world, $200 billion. About $6 billion of that, with a B, is the art crime industry. And that $200 billion number isn't just art. It's not just sculptures, prints, and paintings. It represents, you know, cultural heritage like antiquities, like I said, baseball cards, magazines, comic books, antique automobiles. All of these things are part of the cultural property of the world. And so all of these things come under that aspect, under the art crime team, to be recovered. Even, you know, astronauts' logbooks, for that matter, and, you know, medals given to astronauts on their return to Earth that are stolen. All of these things are part of that cultural heritage, not just Rembrandts and Renoirs, but Mickey Mantle baseball cards as well.
Which can go for a fairly tidy sum.
Well, the record for a Mickey Mantle baseball card from 1952 is $12 million.
I wonder, and the span of your career, I think, is a wonderful frame for this. The explosion in technology that we've seen in the past 20 to 30 years, how has that changed the world of art crime, both from the criminal side and from the investigation side?
Well, you know, the when I first started doing these investigations back in 1988, it's been a long time, there was no internet, there was no situation like that. And what really changes in the world, really throughout civilization, actually, it's the speed of travel and the speed of information. That's really what changes. Everything else pretty much stays the same, you know, when it comes to human beings. But since then, you can see with the exponential speed of travel and information around the world, within minutes of an art heist, everybody in the world knows about it. It's on every internet, it's on the internet all over the world. And that makes a difference, because now it's much more difficult to try to monetize that art once it's been stolen. So you can't take it and, you know, make believe it's yours, you know, and come forward with it and try to sell it under, you know, on some secondary market. Everybody knows. Secondly, the speed of communication, that's the speed of communication, and then travel as well. It's difficult to move these artworks internationally. In Europe, it's a little bit easier because of the EU. They could go between countries without a lot of customs investigations, but you can't bring it into the US. It's very difficult to do that. So that's made a little bit of a difference as well. So I think those things have changed as far as the heists are concerned. You know, the standard heist itself, if it's a gunpoint robbery, it's still rushing in, pointing a gun, and running around stealing the art. That's how it works. And then making a getaway. It's still the same. It's the same as Jesse James robbing a bank, you know, so to speak. When it comes to heist. And the investigation is a little bit different now, too, because of the use of the internet. It's more difficult to go undercover. Undercover agents have to be very careful about their identities. They have to have good, what we call backstopping, which means they have a legitimate history, a storyline that can be checked on the internet. And so all of that's very, very extensive. It's very complicated, and it's got to be done correctly. And so as a result, it's more difficult to be able to do that than it was, say, 30 years ago.
Well, finally, I want to ask one follow-up about a specific piece of technology and kind of looking into the future. Artificial intelligence is growing exponentially, and I wonder if that creates new concerns, especially when it comes to forgery.
Yeah, you know, one of the newest technologies, Warren, that has come out is AI, artificial intelligence. And that creates a situation where it's easier to create forgeries. But ultimately, the artwork that's very highly valued, that is done by, you know, let's say the Abex artists like Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Clifford Still, these pieces that go for literally hundreds of millions of dollars, they have to have a provenance. They have to have a history. So those pieces that are in the catalog raisonné, they call it, which is the catalog of all of the artwork that's been put together academically, these catalogs. If it's not in the catalog, then they're not going to command those prices. They have to be authenticated. And there's very few pieces that are coming out of the woodwork today that can be authenticated. And so as a result, people aren't paying those kind of prices for those artworks. So, you know, you can do forgeries of lesser pieces, you know, a few thousand dollar pieces that, you know, look like 1880, you know, farm scenes, genre scenes, that type of thing. But they're not going to bring the prices that these forgers are looking for. So it's still difficult to be able to monetize even AI forgeries.
So you can't just go to ChatGPT and come back a few minutes later and go, guys, I found a new Jackson Pollock.
Yeah, you can do that. But then you got to prove it's the new Jackson Pollock. And that's very difficult. In fact, it's nearly impossible.
Thanks to retired FBI special agent and founder of the FBI's art crimes team, Robert Whitman, for joining our Martin Matheny on this edition of Arts Playlist. Whitman and University of North Texas professor Laura Evans give their art crime talk presented by the Biggs Museum this Thursday at the Schwartz Center for the Arts in Dover. Tickets and information are at biggsmuseum.org. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we hear stories from student journalists at the University of Delaware. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In this edition of Enlighten Me, we head to the University of Delaware to highlight work from student journalists there. Pieces produced by UD Communications students for a class taught by Nancy Karabjanian, a longtime first-aid journalist, director of UD's journalism program, and one of the founders of Delaware Public Media. Up first, we delve into the world of sports. Last weekend, UFC, the biggest promotion in mixed martial arts, or MMA, brought a card of fights to the White House lawn. But you can also find MMA action locally, far from the UFC spotlight. Recent University of Delaware grad Andrew Fuska gives us a glimpse at what MMA looks like closer to home.
MMA and other martial arts are rising rapidly, with some of the biggest fights garnering millions of views and millions of dollars.
I was actually the first professional fighter in Delaware for MMA and Muay Thai.
That's Delaware's Bazooka Joe Stripling, a martial artist who spent 3 decades calling the cage home.
Back in the day, there was no rear rules. My first professional MMA fight was in a ring, and now they're all in cages.
How long did you train before taking your first fight?
2 weeks. 2 weeks, but I also wrestled my entire life. I had done karate my entire life. We fought in an underground tournament, and I'm winning the tournament, and then I went to a jiu-jitsu school, and 2 weeks later, I fought an actual real MMA fight.
Stripling has over 20 professional bouts under his belt, and after many years of fighting, he opened his own gym in Newark. The gym sits above the Patriot Ice Center and celebrated its 10-year anniversary in April.
On the gym, so it's probably 60 to 80 hours a week just on the gym side, like being here every day. And then I also work a full-time day job at a high school where I'm a security and hospitality ambassador for the school. And I have a 14-year-old son who plays every sport possible known to man, and chess.
Owning the gym is hard work, but for Joe, the reward is greater than the sacrifice.
I also think there's people who are put on this planet to do certain things. And I think I was put on this planet to teach, no matter what martial art or history. Like, I wanted to be a history teacher growing up. The money is not important to me. It's about keeping people wanting to be here and learning martial art.
It's like the best thing. It saved my life. Everybody says, oh, Muay Thai saved my life. It really did.
Joe's passion for martial arts is easy to see, and he loves to pass that down. That was his student, Devin Lucerna, who after years of training under him, now coaches alongside Joe at the gym. Never at a loss for words, Joe and Devin exchanged stories and experiences from inside the ring.
When I got into the ring and I got hit, it was like, it's like when you first fall on a snowboard. You're like, huh, that was fun. Let me get back up and try this again. You want to get hit sometimes, so you can kind of just like turn on your brain and the adrenaline starts rushing.
Stepping foot in the ring, you have to be crazy. You have to be willing to die. And some people don't understand that. And like, that nervousness for me is like, hey, they need to be willing to die. And if they're not, I need to be ready to someone in town would protect him.
No matter how big the sport gets, hardworking pioneers like Bazooka Joe will forever be the lifeblood of it.
I'm never kind of sitting still, and if I am, like I am right now, it's like super awesome.
UD News, I'm Andrew Fuska.
Thanks, Andrew, for your reporting. Our next piece introduces us to a somewhat unusual set of University of Delaware students, women who are both members of a sorority on campus and ROTC cadets. Recent UD grad Jade Cregan reports.
While the sun isn't even up, and most of campus is still fast asleep, for those who balance ROTC and life in a sorority, it's go time. Senior Andrea Pyle mixes these two passions and identities to create a well-rounded college experience. At merely 5'3" tall and a self-declared girly girl in the sorority Chi Omega, this may confuse others, but not Andrea.
It's really funny because, like, so many people will, like, look at me when I'm out of uniform and be like, oh my god, you do ROTC?
Preserving that girly girl attitude and feminine persona when not wearing her combat boots requires a few rituals.
When I can have my nails done, I have them done. Like, if I can dress up when I'm not in uniform, I do, because that's just, like, I make the most out of the time that I don't have to be in uniform.
Andrea isn't the only sorority girl in an ROTC uniform.
I like to dress up for class when I can, so I feel like it's a good balance, and honestly, sometimes it's fun to not have to pick what I'm wearing to work out every day.
That was junior Kathleen Zamrowski, an ROTC cadet who is also in Chi Omega and serves as their social chair. For her, the chance to focus on Kathleen the woman over Kathleen the soldier is a great way to get that feminine fix.
My personality a lot, like, can shine through what I'm wearing. And then certain opportunities for, like, events, like we do a military ball. I don't wear a lot of pink, but this year I'm wearing a pink dress.
Despite their seemingly unusual mix of extracurriculars, Andrea and Kathleen both said they have never felt iced out by the other ROTC cadets. If anything, their biggest worry was not understanding the jargon used in training.
The first day, like, I was talking to somebody and they were like, oh yeah, when we have a ruck. And I was like, what's a ruck? And I felt so stupid asking that. And they were like, well, it's this thing where we put like 35 pounds in a bag and we put it on our, it's like a backpack, and we just walk for miles, and we do 6 miles, 8 miles, and 12 miles.
ROTC Captain Wendy Dill said that it is not uncommon for women in ROTC to also be in sororities.
There's no benefit or not benefit if you're in a sorority. So it doesn't help you, but it doesn't hurt you either. And we know that cadets are college kids, so we want them to have that full college experience where they're getting to go to class and they get to be in sororities and do all those things, but then also they're learning how to be a leader in the Army.
She also said that there are still several misconceptions when it comes to women in ROTC.
We do have a very significant amount of females, so I think that's like a misconception, is like the ROTC is a man's world, and it's really not.
Whether it's hiking 12 miles in uniform with a 35-pound pack or planning sorority events, Andrea and Kathleen are proof that sorority life and ROTC cadetship can coexist.
Like Kathleen and I, we have each other, which helps a lot.
For UD News, I'm Jade Cregan.
Thanks, Jade, for your piece. And we close with University of Delaware rising senior Shelby Murphy, who explores how college students are joining the trend to seek out the pops and hisses that come with returning to vinyl records as a way to listen to music.
We live in an era of infinite playlists and on-demand culture. The way we listen to music has become frictionless. But for UD student Joey Barnyai, the appeal lies in a little more resistance.
I would definitely say, like, listening to vinyls, like, it's more of a experience or more of, like, a production. It's a lot, it's completely analog, or mostly analog, so there's a lot more setting things up. Like, it's more of a production. It's not just click a button.
That production is a tangible connection. For student collectors like Aiden Mallett-Prevot, the appeal isn't just the music. It's the physical history printed on the back of a 12-inch cardboard sleeve.
Yeah, I mean, it's much more tactile, and you pick out what you're looking at, you see the album art, you can look at the credits and everything, and it's not something you can really do with a Spotify song. I think there's a feature now on Spotify, and maybe YouTube, where you can look at the credits for the song, but it's very minimal. But, like, here you can see everyone who's singing, all the musicians in this band, Everyone's produced it. Everyone was involved in the album in the back.
But why go through the work? Why pay $30 for a disc that pops and hisses when you can stream a perfect version for free? Philip Gentry, a musicologist at the University of Delaware, says we are living through a connoisseurship crisis.
Streaming disrupts all of that. It makes it very hard to be a connoisseur in a certain way, because you can sort of listen to anything all the time, and so you don't have to like make choices. But I do also see students that are trying to sort of push back against that streaming culture and almost mimicking the practices, not even of their parents necessarily, but of their grandparents.
For Joey, that connection to the past is literal. His collection isn't just a hobby, it's a family archive that bridges the gap between the digital age and the late 1960s.
My grandmother gave me a bunch of her old records that I listened to, which is pretty cool. Like a lot of like older jazz, like maybe late 60s, early 70s maybe. Like the old school element, definitely like thinking about like this is like what people did before the internet, you know? That's kind of fun about it.
Professor Gentry notes that while the industry tries to monetize this trend, the real value is in the intentionality it forces upon the listener. In an era of AI and robotic perfection, the skips and scratches make the music feel human again.
That having to like listen carefully and closely to music is a skill you have to learn. But I'm really glad that there is a little bit of a sort of fad, even if it's just a fad, for that kind of like careful, attentive listening.
While digital files are technically permanent, there's a newfound value in an object that can skip, scratch, and eventually wear out. Shelby Murphy, UD News.
Thanks to UD rising senior Shelby Murphy and recent UD grads Jade Cregan and Andrew Fuska for enlightening us this week. And we've hit the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, University of Delaware student journalist Jade Cregan, Andrew Fuska, and Shelby Murphy, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny, and our producer, Jay Shaw. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. Hi, I'm Delaware Public Media News Director Tom Byrne, host of The Green. Thanks for listening this week. I just want to take a moment to remind you about Delaware Public Media's end of fiscal year fund drive. And we still need your support for The Green and our local news coverage. We're proud of The Green. It's won local and national awards for bringing you stories and interviews focused solely on the First State. Our staff and contributors cover a wide spectrum of topics and issues, from politics and the environment to education and the arts. But it doesn't happen without you, the public in Delaware Public Media. If you value what The Green brings you each week and want to keep it going, please take some time to show it by supporting our end of fiscal year fund drive. We're still trying to fill the loss of federal funding. For us, that means $165,000 per year each year going forward. So please, head to DelawarePublic.org and donate right now. And again, thank you so much for listening to The Green here on Delaware Public Media.